from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Mitt Romney wins Illinois and loses on Etch-a-Sketch. President Obama pushes all of the above energy and fury over the killing of Trayvon Martin. Mitt Romney's top aide, Eric Fernstrom, said Romney could pivot to moderates for the fall campaign. His toy metaphor enraged the conservatives Romney's been courting.
I think you hit a reset button for the fall campaign. Everything changes. It's almost like an Etch-a-Sketch. You can kind of shake it up and we start all over again.
Newt Gingrich says drill to cut gas prices. The president said this week we need brain power.
We are drilling more. We are producing more. But the fact is, producing more oil at home isn't enough by itself to bring gas prices down.
And at a march in New York, one of many this week, Trayvon Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, called for justice.
We need this kind of support.
Yes!
We love your hair.
Our son is your son.
Yes!
I want you guys to stand up for justice.
Yes!
And stand up for what's right.
Yes, ma'am.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Susan Davis of USA Today, Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. With us today from Washington, Susan Davis, chief congressional correspondent for USA Today. Susan, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom.
And from Washington, Clarence Page is here, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and editorial board member at the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, very happy to have you.
Happy to be here, Tom. Thanks.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Susan, and Clarence.
Hi, Jack.
Everybody, I want to go straight to the Trayvon Martin case. There's a lot to talk about today, but boy, the anguish and the anger over this has just been rolling across the country today, really roiling many communities, in a way the whole country. Here's a little sense of just one perspective on this, but a very important one. Here's Devin Gertman. This is a black 16-year-old. He was at a town hall meeting yesterday organized by the NAACP in Sanford, Florida. This was on Wednesday. He wore a box of Skittles around his neck and explained why the shooting of Trayvon Martin made him fear for his own safety.
It's scary because I'm 16. I wouldn't want to walk down the street and get shot just walking down the street trying to get snacks from my brother. I mean, it's not right, and it shouldn't be ignored.
It's not right, and it shouldn't be ignored. There are consequences already. Sanford Police Chief Bill Lee has stepped aside. Exactly what that means, we don't know yet. But on Thursday, here he talked about stepping aside in response to criticism of his handling of the Trayvon Martin case.
It is apparent that my involvement in this matter is overshadowing the process. Therefore, I have come to the decision that I must temporarily remove myself from the position as police chief for the city of Sanford. I do this in the hopes of restoring some semblance of calm to the city, which has been in turmoil for several weeks.
Clarence Page. There's an issue here for this family and their son, and they're looking for justice, and we've heard that from his parents all week long. But there's also something here, and what is it the country is working out, is addressing in this furor over this case, Clarence?
Well, Tom, in my self-appointed position as the pundit who makes sense of the world for everybody else.
Please try. We're all trying.
My impression is that this is an episode in which race has come back into the public consciousness and the public dialogue. You know, there was a lot of talk around Barack Obama's election of post-racial politics, post-racial era, et cetera. And black folks were saying, well, not so soon, mm-hmm. not so quickly. We still view the world in with different perspectives, and African Americans have responded to this episode with a sense that the suspect George Zimmerman in this case, the shooter, would not have been treated in the way he was, or the victim would not have been treated the way he was. His body laid there for 3 days in the morgue. Before the some detective bothered to check his cell phone to find out who he was, and it appears his parents could find out where he was. This all happened back in February, and we probably still would not be talking about it had they not released the 911 tapes last week. And the scenario was so stark as people listened to hear what sounded like a black youth being stalked because he looked suspicious to George Zimmerman. A neighborhood watch guy, I've heard, self-appointed neighborhood or mm-hmm. semi-self-appointed, mm-hmm. Who who invoked self-defense as his reason for shooting Trayvon. That is in dispute now, which brings up this five-year-old law, the Stand Your Ground law in Florida, which at least 21 states have also passed. So there's a lot of different reasons why this story has had legs.
Susan, we've got the Justice Department involved now. They're investigating this through the Civil Rights Division. There is action in Florida, a new attention from the state government, and as we just heard there, the local police chief stepping aside for at least for some time while this is investigated. How's it rippling through Washington? And do you expect the Justice Department to really get involved here? Can you tell yet if they intend to, do something material here besides take a look?
Well, I definitely think that the Justice Department is facing a tremendous amount of pressure to take this very seriously and come in and resolve some issues in a case that looks like so far has been maybe clumsily prosecuted at best by the local police. It has actually rippled back into Washington. I think you had leading members of Congress, certainly members of the Congressional Black Caucus, and even House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi publicly weighing in on this week, saying that justice needs to be done, that this needs to be taken very seriously. So I do think that this is one of those cases where it touches on so many issues of racial discrimination, of gun right laws, of perhaps even mental illness laws, and that it's going it touches on so many issues that it's going to involve a larger national debate. And it is raising a lot of issues in Washington as well. Now, whether the Justice Department can prosecute this case, it is unclear. I think they're looking at it. I think they're looking at it very seriously because of the national public interest in it. But I think it's too soon to tell exactly what they're going to be able to do.
Jack Beatty, the word out of Florida had been that in this case, Mr. Zimmerman might not be able to be prosecuted because of the law that Clarence cited here, the Stand Your Ground law, which says there is no duty to retreat anywhere before using force in self-defense. And, of course, Zimmerman's saying it was self-defense. Now, the parents who listen to the tape, almost anybody who listens to the tape of those 911 calls has got to have big questions about that depiction of what went on there. But that's the claim he made. It's been made by many other Floridians in the years, a half dozen years since this new law came into effect. And many of them have just walked after shooting.
Yes, according to an interview on NPR, reports of justifiable homicide have tripled since the law went into effect. Of course, opponents call it the right to commit murder law. And it passed under heavy lobbying from the NRA, which set up a grassroots campaign about, being able to shoot home intruders without fear of prosecution, and which spent liberally $165,000 in contributions to the Florida Republican Party, substantial contributions to 23 legislators, 22 Republicans, one Democrat. And, of course, the legislature passed it with 22 of the 23 recipients of NRA funds voting for the bill. Last year in Arizona, the shooting of Gabrielle Giffords and the killing of her aide and the little girl, the horror, there was talk in Congress about dealing with the issue of the clips and the pistol use, limit the number of bullets you could shoot. The NRA killed that in Washington. And even while this was going on, while things were working toward the publicity to being known in Florida, the NRA was in Washington lobbying to nationalize these Stand Your Ground laws. So the juggernaut of the NRA again.
Clarence, we had the irony this week of the Supreme Court looking at law around 16-year-olds being sent to prison for life without parole while George Zimmerman isn't even arrested in this murder case. That was kind of a tough irony this week.
Well, yeah, and we won't know what the court has decided until they've decided it. But it's rather shocking to see how juveniles have been treated in so many cases where we thought, juveniles were automatically not going to be charged with serious crimes the way adults are.
Well, there were serious crimes. There were some shocking killings, but nevertheless, life without parole. And here's Zimmerman. He's a full adult, and there's nothing.
Exactly. And this debate has gone on for several years, and for good reason. Again, I don't know how the court is going to decide on this, but it's very revelatory to see how the law is enforced in different ways and different levels in different states.
Susan, I'm just wondering about, I mean, the NRA sitting in the middle of all this, or kind of at the edge of it, but as Jack says, they're pushing for standard ground laws around the country. Where do you see the NRA's influence these days in Washington with the background of this case?
I'm not sure. Jack makes a lot of good points. The NRA is certainly a very powerful lobbying force in Washington. But the reality is that many members of Congress, there's not a lot of appetite in Congress to repeal any kind of gun laws or enhance gun laws. I think, and Gabby Giffords, the shooting there is a great example. That re-sparked a debate over whether we needed stronger gun laws. But what complicated that case, and what I think there is a similar complication here, is that even beyond the racism element that's going on in Florida, there does raise a question of competency to the person that committed the crime. And we saw that in Arizona.
You mentioned that before. Is there a competency issue with George Zimmerman?
Well,
I had not heard that.
I think that the things that you have read about him in terms of his prior arrest records, that he had been, anecdotally, neighbors talked about he had a sort of almost obsession about black males and crime in the neighborhood, that he was not a registered member of any neighborhood watch group, but had taken this role upon himself.
Picked up his 9mm. But if all that goes to competency, there's a lot of people who could be in that category. Susan Davis, please stand by with USA Today in Washington. Clarence Page is with the Chicago Tribune. Jack Beatty, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news this hour. Trayvon Martin, the furor there, Mitt Romney's Etch-a-Sketch, energy issues, and charges out against Staff Sergeant Robert Bales for murder in Afghanistan. Susan Davis joins us, Chief Congressional Correspondent for USA Today. Clarence Page is here from the Chicago Tribune, joins us also from Washington. Our own Jack Beatty is here. And Susan, Clarence, Jack, I want to go right to our listeners. Savannah, Georgia. Brian's calling. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Well, I think this is a perfect example and a time for us to recognize that American institutional racism won't be wiped away we've got 50 years of civil rights issues now being at the forefront. This is a perfect example that it's not necessarily a black and white thing with Zimmerman having Latino descent. Racism is exemplary in how this police force, I don't know if they're just inept, allowed this man who killed a young black teenager and just took his word for it. That's where the racism comes into part. There was no gun found. There was no weapon found. The 911 operator obviously had told the gentleman to cease and desist in chasing the young man.
Yep.
And I mean, the first thing that came out of his mouth that he looks like he's on drugs. How can you tell he looks like he's on drugs? What is that?
And of course, I mean, there were some very racially charged comments that he made to the 911 operator there that haven't been played as much because they're just hard to hear. But, Brian, we've got that sort of spotlight that appears that it may fall on racism in a really tough way here. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Kathy in Lansing, Michigan. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm all right. What do you know, Kathy?
Well, my parents and my aunt and uncle, who are educators, retired and moved to Sanford in 2005. Both my mom and stepdad and my aunt and uncle built beautiful homes there.
Okay.
And thought they were going to have a peaceful retirement, and shortly thereafter found that they were in a community that they noticed discrimination in.
Are they African American, Kathy?
Multiracial.
Okay.
My stepdad and my uncle are black.
Mm-hmm.
And I had taken the initiative to email Bill Lee a few days ago.
The police chief there.
Just to get the police chief, I wanted to know from him why I should be comfortable with my parents and my aunt and uncle being there with this situation. And he emailed me back, and I was a little bit taken aback by the short response he gave me.
What'd he say?
And
it's kind of amazing the email you at all. He must have had a lot on his plate this week.
Well, I was very specific about my concern that if it's not safe to visit there, it must not be safe to live there. And I turned around and responded to his email by emailing the city manager and the mayor with some specific concerns that I had, and I've not gotten a return email from them. But my question was, why are you dragging your feet? What is it with you two people who are at this level of management being okay with the level of indifference that this child was treated with and the inept, incompetent investigation of this child's killing?
Kathy, I think I saw on television that Sanford has a black city manager. I mean, it's not as though...
He has some problems, Tom. I did some research on my own, and he is part of a federal civil rights discrimination case. He's been deposed. He is due to go to trial in July in Topeka, Kansas.
The African-American city manager?
There.
I don't know the details of that, Kathy, but it's interesting to hear the firsthand kind of reporting from your family in Sanford, and I appreciate your call. Let me get a couple more, and I'll take it to our panel. Irina in Framingham, Massachusetts. Irina, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel terrible just by listening such discussion. Number one, because I work with quite few African Americans, and I hear very often from them that it's safe to be on the street where they live. So the police, we are judging already the police officer not knowing results of investigation, not knowing what this police officer saw in terms of body language of this poor boy. And I feel terrible for his parents. But reportings like that increase tensions in the public. And I just feel horrible just by listening. We are by even talking in such way that policeman is guilty, policeman should be arrested, not knowing results of investigation, it's just increasing tensions in this society.
You're afraid it's a rush to judgment. I mean, we do need to point out there, it was not a policeman. It was a neighborhood watch volunteer, practically self-appointed there. But of course, there's always a rush to judgment concern here. I appreciate your call, Irina. Susan, it's interesting. Here's a comment from Isaac online, and he says that this event, it gives him pause to wonder about neighborhood watch programs themselves at a time when police budgets are being cut/ nationwide. There might be an incentive to place greater reliance upon citizens to police their neighborhoods themselves. I can well imagine that dynamic kicking in here, Susan. In lots and lots of communities, police budgets have been cut back, and who knows who's stepping up with their own 9mm.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think police departments, I speak a little bit personally because I have two brothers who are police officers and mm-hmm. who have been involved in town budget battles themselves. And right now in most states are facing budget restrictions. And oftentimes police and fire units are some of the places that feel the cutbacks. And it's usually not dramatic, but, you know, three or four less officers on the street is tough for a lot of community small town communities. This one's much tougher than, I think, policing your local neighborhoods. But it does raise the question of sort of vigilante justice and people taking matters into their own hands. And I do think, I think part of the reason why this has struck so many people is it's both of those issues. It seems that there is some element of police, I don't, you know, want to malign them, or alleged police misconduct. And then on the other hand, people sort of feeling the need to police their own neighborhoods. And to your other caller's point, it sounds like this area in particular of Florida has a certain history of racial tension.
And we hear it right there in the call. Clarence, I want to bring that to you. But first, Sarah in Belmont, Massachusetts. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make the point that Tom, you were saying that the whole country is in sort of a state of outrage.
Well, a lot of people, I guess. Mm.
But, you know, if you listen to conservative talk radio, which I do sometimes just mm-hmm. to know what people are saying,
yep.
I was listening to a Michael Smirkanish show, and two callers called in. One said that if what was this black boy doing in a white, mostly white neighborhood? If he was in my neighborhood, I'd have shot him too. And then
wow.
another caller called in to say that Zimmerman should be given the keys to the city because he got rid of a potential criminal.
I mean,
so, you know, there's a section of the population who are totally on the other side. It's very shocking and very frightening.
Sarah, I appreciate your call. Clarence Pageman, here we are in this gated community. I was reading in this past week, it may have been a mainly white community at some point, but after all the turmoil in the housing market, it's now majority minority by a little bit anyway. But you hear what our listener Sarah is hearing on conservative talk radio, all kinds of attitudes here, and our very first caller says, hey, this is racism showing itself. She says she's got people saying, you know, in my neighborhood, I'd do the same.
Well, as I said earlier, what we see dramatized here again is how African Americans and white Americans in general have two different views of the world, two different views of racism, what it is, how it works, how prevalent is it. Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, others, you know, fall along the spectrum as far as community attitudes go. But let's face it, the basic racial matrix in the country is black and white. And that part of Florida, you know, Florida is a fascinating state. It's about five different states. Orlando, when the company I work for, the Chicago Tribune Company, bought the Orlando Sentinel, there were only about 20,000 people or so there. But Disney World was only about a year old. Now something like a million and a half or more. So what you've done is you've got a largely northern population that has mixed in recent years with a very southern rural part of central Florida. And I think what we're seeing here in this whole sad episode is a clash between the old Florida and the new as far as that region goes in transition. But, you know, I'm not blaming Florida, but I am blaming that law, that Stand Your Ground law. Florida was the first state to pass it. Governor Jeb Bush was governor at the time. And he said that this is good, sound, common sense legislation. It sailed on through. 21 states at least have passed similar laws now. And now we're seeing what the folks were talking about back at the time of the debate when they said that this was a kill first law or shoot first law, it was called, or as Jack Beatty said, a license to kill law.
And it turns around, and now we're dealing maybe with fallout exactly from that. You don't even have to be in your home for it to come into effect. We're going to learn much more about how this case unfolds in the days ahead. George Zimmerman's still lying very low, and still the call's very high for his arrest. We will follow it. I want to turn to politics this week. There was a high moment for Mitt Romney when he came in with a big win over Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul, for that matter, in Illinois. Quite a convincing victory in the polls. It all fell apart pretty quickly in the week, but here was Romney celebrating that victory in Illinois.
After years of too many apologies and not enough jobs, historic drops in income and historic highs in gas prices, a president who doesn't hesitate to use all the means necessary to force through Obamacare on the American public, but leads from behind in the world, it's time to say these words. This word. Enough. We've had enough.
Enough. We've had enough. And then came his very top aide's comment on the Etch-a-Sketch. Now, Eric Fernstrom is sort of Mitt Romney's, he's been described as Mitt Romney's David Axelrod. He is right up there. This is not some junior staff member. And he was on CNN, asked about how all the conservative talk might unfold in the fall when, if it's Mitt Romney against Barack Obama, when he's got to go after that independent vote, maybe more moderate. And of course, he said, everything changes. It's almost like an Etch-a-Sketch. You can kind of shake it up and restart all over again. Romney's opponents were all over that. Here's Newt Gingrich in Louisiana on Wednesday.
Now, given everybody's fears about Governor Romney's flip-flops, to have his communications director say publicly to all of us, if we're dumb enough to nominate him, we should expect that by the acceptance speech, he'll move back to the left, triggers everything people are worried about.
They waved Etch-a-Sketches and had their fun. Here's Rick Santorum sort of mocking Mitt Romney after the advisor, Eric Fernstrom, compared his candidate, in a sense, or the candidacy, to Etch-a-Sketch.
Imagine, had Mitt Romney been around at the time we were drafting our Constitution, he'd have just shaken it and just shook it up after it was approved to rewrite it. We're talking about big things here, folks. This isn't a joke or a game. We're talking about important things in our society here.
Jack Beatty, sometimes metaphors hit and they stick. And this is a rough one for Mitt Romney, at least if this week is any evidence. I mean, that Etch-a-Sketch is everywhere. They're selling like hotcakes. Everybody's talking about him. And for the moment, anyway, you think Romney, you think Etch-a-Sketch. Shake it up.
Oh, the perfection of felicity of that metaphor, it just can't be matched. I mean, and that's what makes it so damning for the governor. Just this week, Bill Salatin of Slate has done a 10-page analysis of Romney's positions. Really, one of the first things that was erased from the Etch-a-Sketch, his positions on abortions, and he writes, Romney has made three claims about his past: that he never called himself pro-choice, that his defense of abortion rights was philosophical rather than political, and that until 2004, the issue was just an abstraction to him. None of these claims is true. And he goes on to prove that. None of those claims are true. It's one thing for him to, on the Etch-a-Sketch, to revise his own past. It's his, after all. If he wants to prevaricate about it, that's his life. But he is also practices a severe economy of truth when it comes to talking about the president. For example, in his very first speech, when he began his campaign a year ago, he asserted the president inherited a recession and made it worse. That wasn't true. He was then asked by a reporter, Mr. Romney, you said something that wasn't true. The recession isn't worse. And he said, I didn't say that. So he was erasing the Etch-a-Sketch just after, maybe two or three days. He was out. That had disappeared. Just a week ago, he said that the president gave a speech, the State of the Union address. He didn't even mention the deficit or debt. The president mentioned it six times. He said the president failed to place sanctions on Iran. That is not true. He said just a week ago the president doubled the deficit. No, that's not true. So he keeps saying these things about reality, and then if people catch him on it, he erases it and revises. And it just raises such fundamental questions about his political character. What is he? Who is he? And when will he stop this endless process of erasing and coming up with a new version?
Clarence Page, you're with the Chicago Tribune. What are you thinking about the Illinois victory and then this Etch-a-Sketch and truth issue that's boomed up right behind it?
Well, I can't improve on what Jack just said insofar as the Etch-a-Sketch metaphor and the damage it does. Metaphors do the most damage when they have some element of truth to them, and this one does have a high element of credibility that Romney's had to deal with. Illinois, I think the significance of it is that it shows, on the one hand, it confirms the sense of inevitability that many of us have had all along about Romney and the nomination. On the other, it shows how he still has a long, hard slog ahead if he can't do better than 49%. He's still, even in a state like Illinois, which ought to be tailor-made for him, it's very moderate Republicans, heavily urban and suburban, whereas Rick Santorum does his best with a more rural and Christian evangelical crowd, like in Iowa and other locations. We've seen this pattern develop. At present, looks like Romney's not, even if he proceeds at his current rate, he won't have enough delegates to clinch the nomination until sometime in June. And that's significant because does he get better as a candidate, like we saw Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton improved on the campaign trail, or does he get worse? Does he do even more of these Etch-a-Sketch sort of gaffes or changes in his rhetoric? That remains to be seen.
Susan, our time is short before the break, but this is very wounding comment this week, and the way it kicked back on the candidate. Does the GOP go all the way with a wounded candidate here? Is he a wounded candidate?
He's a winning candidate, but he's going to go all the way. I just think the inevitability of Mitt Romney is one that you can't dispute, in no small part because, a perfect example is the endorsement this week of Jeb Bush, which I don't think was a very warm endorsement. He said it's just time to close ranks behind this guy.
And it got stepped on right away by Etch-a-Sketch. I'm sorry, Susan, here's the break right here. Susan Davis, Clarence Page, Jack Beatty, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, French Interior Minister Claude Guéant described the death of gunman Mohamed Merah after a 32-hour standoff in Toulouse, France.
The killer came out of the bathroom. He was shooting violently. His shots were frequent and severe. The police officers tried to protect themselves, and he tried to protect himself. But in the end, Mohamed Merah jumped through the window with one weapon in his hand while he was still shooting.
A rough week for France. In the U.S., the NFL suspended New Orleans Saints coach Sean Payton for a full year over the Saints' bounties for hard hits, hits that would injure. Here's one, and NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell making the announcement.
Wow, did he get hit? Kurt Warner still down.
It was clearly out of control that they identified specific players and targeted them for injury. That's simply unacceptable in the NFL.
And the killing of Trayvon Martin all over, including in this hip-hop protest song from rapper Jaziri X.
Stay calm, it's just little Trayvon, but he wanna be the hero, so he put his cape on. George Zimmerman, neighborhood block captain, loaded Glock strapped in, fake cop has been, got out the car, ignored what the cops asked him. They always get away, this time that will not happen.
We're looking at a week in the news. Trayvon Martin, Führer Mitt Romney's Etch-a-Sketch, energy issues, and charges out today against Staff Sergeant Robert Bales for murder in Afghanistan. Susan Davis of USA Today is with us. Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Is the president to blame for high gas prices? Is he right that the answer to energy problems is brain power? Is Sergeant Bales defensible on the Afghan murders? And what are you thinking on the French killer, the Rutgers verdict, the NFL coming down hard on hit bounties? I want to get to energy, but one more call on Paul in Norwell, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
I just want to point out, I think it's wonderfully ironic that the Romney campaign has handed its opponents a pitch-perfect metaphor and prop all wrapped up in one. It was a gigantic mistake. I don't think it'll hurt Romney ultimately in the long run, but right now it's probably hurting him, at least in the public image. But I think it speaks to a larger point that Romney is a man whose political essence consists of calculations, not convictions. It goes to what type of businessman he is and was. He wasn't a businessman like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, who created the product, stuck with the product, worked with the product. He was a balance sheet technician who looked at a company that he had just purchased or wanted to purchase and figured out what was working, what wasn't, and then liquidated what wasn't working. He does the same thing with his positions and his convictions. If something isn't working or he perceives it won't work, he liquidates it and comes up with something else.
Paul, we've got it. You've been watching closely. Your spreadsheet is pretty well laid out there on Mitt Romney. But, of course, he is the leader in the GOP at this point, and he says exactly that business background is what the country needs now. I guess voters will have a chance to decide. I want to take calculations and convictions and turn toward energy for a minute. A lot of talk about that this week. The president all over the country banging the drum on his perspective on energy. But Newt Gingrich, once again, out there saying, come on, all it takes is drilling and we can really push prices down on gasoline. Here he was with NPR's Steve Inskeep on Wednesday saying that the president would have the capability to dramatically lower gas prices through more oil drilling.
I'm astounded at the elite media's passionate refusal to deal with supply and demand. We have had an explosion in production of natural gas. The price of natural gas has dropped from $7.97 a unit to $2.35 this week. A comparable reduction in the price of oil would mean $1.13 a gallon gasoline.
$1.13 a gallon gasoline, Clarence Page, that sounds pretty good right now, though here's an Associated Press story yesterday saying more U.S. drilling won't drop gas prices. They'd looked at 36 years of inflation-adjusted gasoline prices, put it up against domestic oil production, and they didn't find that it would put it down, though Newt Gingrich says, look at natural gas, it would.
Newt Gingrich has taught us two things. One is that you can blame anything on the, quote, elite media, including gas prices.
Yeah, well.
And number two, you can say anything you want about where gas prices ought to be or where they would be.
$1.13, it's happy days again.
Sorry?
$1.13, you're back, it's happy days time. The Fonz, practically.
Well, you know, he's been saying all along, the 260, I think he was saying, yeah. A vote for me and you're going to have 260 a gallon. He hasn't told us how that's going to happen, what he's going to do. We'd love to hear him tell us now if he...
Said drill everywhere. Look what happened with natural gas. He is right. Natural gas prices have come way down, This AP story is saying that the market dynamics, Susan, in oil are different from natural gas. You've got an international market, and it wouldn't work the same way. But it does make a kind of native sense to a lot of people when Newt Gingrich says, look, put more out there, supply and demand, prices go down.
What he doesn't talk about is how we're exporting oil right now.
No, that's true.
I'm sorry. I interrupted, but it's true. We're exporting oil. He doesn't talk about that at all.
The most important thing to remember about energy policy is there is no such thing as short-term energy policy. There is energy by nature. Any kind of energy policy is generally viewed as a 10-year strategy. So a lot of this is because it's a political year and because by nature of the world markets and by the nature of a election year, we know gas is going to go up this summer. And I think part of the reason why the president is trying to get out in front of this issue and look like he is responding to this issue is that there has been a coordinated effort on the right to link high gas prices to President Obama's energy policies. Now, there is a lot of holes to poke in that, one being, as Clarence just mentioned, that we are exporting oil right now, that there's market factors at play here, particularly as we look at the situation in the Middle East and potential for unrest there that could drive the oil prices far more than anything that Barack Obama can do in the short term.
But whether the president's got an answer fully up to the challenge, I mean, doesn't that still stand out there? I mean, we've got those gas prices are bugging people. He was talking this week about brain power, but how fast does that deliver? George Bush talked about hydrogen cells. Well, we're still waiting.
He is answering it, Tom. That's why he's on the road this week talking about fast-tracking part of the Keystone Pipeline, which he didn't even approve of or support initially. And, there are different things presidents do. He's being pushed to open up the petroleum reserves, being pushed by Democrats. Republicans are trying to block the president's ability to do that at the same time. So a lot of politics being played right now.
Here was the president. Jack, sorry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just to balance, I mean, we're talking about Mitt Romney's way with the truth. The president has been saying out there that, the U.S. only has 2% or 3% or 4%, he said the other day, of U.S. oil, of world oil reserves, and we have 20% of the demand. Well, the fact checker of the Washington Post looked at that and he said that's really kind of it misrepresents the reality that he's talking about existing, resources. If we opened X and Y and Z and, put an oil well in Martha's Vineyard, no, we'd have plenty more than 2% of the world's resources. So the president is, if not lying, he's managing the truth on that one.
Well, all kinds of management going on here. Let's go to Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Jack kind of covered what I was going to say about the president. I think with about 11.6% of the oil produced that this country does.
Yes, I'm reading exactly that number here. Mm-hmm.
And there's studies by our own government that says that we have possibly 400 to 600 billion barrels of recoverable oil, and some petroleum companies they've shown that we have possibly 1,200,000,000,000 possible barrels.
Well, Jerry, do you think Newt Gingrich is right then? We could knock it down to $1.13 a gallon for gasoline in this country?
I don't know if we'll see $1.13, but I know we could do a lot better than what we are.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's exactly the point here. Again, this Associated Press looked at this big survey. You're right. They say the U.S. has about 11% of the world's output. But if we increase that by 50%, which would be an enormous increase in our oil output, it would at most, they found, cut gas prices by 10%. That doesn't get us to $1.13, but here we are. Steve in Rockford, Illinois. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to point out that approximately 4 years ago, at this exact moment in time, gas was also at $4 a gallon. I was beginning a 100-mile one-way commute to go to graduate school, so I got hit really hard by it. And that was under President George W. Bush. And it was an election year, and we had a change in administration, and gas prices dropped. It looks like the cycle's repeating itself, but it just goes to show that the president does not have as much control over gas prices as people think. And I think a more diverse portfolio in domestic energy is going to get us out of the import problem that's hitting us at the gas pump.
There it is, exactly what presidents can do about these things. Of course, policies matter, as Susan says, over time. I mean, the president was out this week talking brain power. He was in four states, as Clarence points out, talking a lot about energy and his all-of-the-above energy approach. Here he was, a little sound of him at Ohio State University on Thursday. He praised a team of students there that had built an electric car capable of going 300 miles per hour, saying their ingenuity was an example of what the country needed.
I don't know who's going to need to go that fast, but it is a testament to the ingenuity here at Ohio State and what is essential to American leadership when it comes to energy, our brain power.
Brain power. Jack, what do you say? And the president is drawing an interesting thing here. He sort of sets it up so it's Newt Gingrich calling for, like, brute drilling, and he's calling for brain power. But brain power doesn't turn into alternatives overnight, and people are frustrated right now about those gas prices.
They are, and there's no doubt that at least a couple of weeks ago, there was an evident correlation between the rise in prices in the fall and Mr. Obama's approval ratings. And if it persists, if prices go up, you can expect a further erosion of support for him. On the plus side, this week, the Saudi Arabia announced that they were going to try to cut prices, increase production to bring prices down about 25%. They had ordered up super tankers, and within, I think the figure was 3 or 4 weeks, these should start arriving at Gulf ports, and the supply should increase. So who knows whether that will have an effect. On the other hand, we also have Bernie Sanders in the Senate. He's talking very seriously about, look, we have to look into speculation here, that these prices are being – he wants the Commodity Credit Commission to look into particularly Goldman Sachs speculating in the market and driving prices up.
Susan, take us to Congress for a minute. That's your specialty, and there is a lot of action on the Republican front, or at least talk and proposals this week on the budget front. Paul Ryan of Wisconsin back in the news again. What are they proposing there? What's the shape of it, and where does it go, or does it go?
The most important thing to remember about a budget resolution is that it's non-binding and it does not have the force of law. But it is, in a lot of ways, a vision document. It's what parties often use to explain how they view the size and scope of government and how we should spend our tax dollars. And the House will vote on this. They're expected to pass it, and they'll vote on it next week. And what you're seeing is a worldview that is dramatically different than a fiscal blueprint that President Obama put out earlier this month. Mm-hmm. It was written by Paul Ryan. I think he's increasingly becoming a familiar national figure. And it's largely similar to the budget that Republicans passed last year. I think the most controversial and focused on point of his budget is what Republicans are proposing to do to Medicare. Last year, Republicans proposed essentially to change the guarantee program and instead allow seniors allotted amounts of money to buy insurance on the private market,
right,
to put it more into the private sector.
Which Democrats said would effectively privatize Medicare.
Exactly. And effectively it would in a certain respect. This year they've walked that proposal back a little bit. It's watered down a little bit. Their current plan would keep Medicare as it currently exists, but give future beneficiaries an option to opt out of the program. We saw similar proposals to this under President George W. Bush on Social Security, that you would have the option to take your money out of the system and invest it in a private system. This is going to be a critical issue in congressional campaigns this year.
Is the same complaint being made that would privatize it, or is this a compromise or not?
There was one Democrat, Ron Wyden, who's a senator from Oregon, who had helped author this specific proposal with Paul Ryan. Mm-hmm. But Democrats broadly in the White House certainly do not support it. They argue that it is the beginning of a chipping away of the Medicare guarantee, and they don't support it. Democrats' popular refrain is our plan for Medicare is to save Medicare. I do think that Democrats believe that they have a very strong political advantage in this because Medicare as a program continues to poll very highly with the American people. The Pew Research Center, which is a nonpartisan outfit, polled Americans on just their views. And they were asked, do you think a Medicare has been good for the country? And something upwards of 80% of Americans believe that the program has been good. The question is whether it's financially sustainable. Now, on the other end, you have to give Republicans some credit. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of courage in Washington right now in terms of putting, you know, your name on the line of specific proposals to what you would do. So there's an element of political bravery that Republicans are taking on by endorsing this, and they and the party largely has almost unanimously endorsed the idea. Only four Republicans voted against the budget last year in the House, and I would imagine the number will be similar this time around. Almost all Republican senators voted for it. So they're really putting themselves on the line. And we're seeing it in races across the country. And just one example, Montana has a Senate race right now between Senator John Tester, and he's being challenged by the congressman there. And Medicare is a crucial issue because 17% of Montanans are Medicare beneficiaries. So this is an issue that is deeply potent in the state. And I think if win or lose, that the victory there will probably be an indicator of how potent the Medicare issue is in the electorate.
Susan, are we on track to be back in the kind of bloody budget battle again this summer that we saw last summer? Is that going to be in the middle of the presidential summer campaign or not?
It's possible. I don't want to get too much into the technical details, but what Republicans essentially did is in their budget is they've lowered the amount of spending that they're going to authorize for the government for the next fiscal year, which Democrats say violates an agreement that they had that they negotiated last summer coming out of the debt ceiling. That they had come to a two-year agreement on what the discretionary spending of the federal government would be. And Republicans came back this spring and said, you know, we're going to cut it a little bit lower. And Democrats are saying, well, how can we work with you? With a deal is a deal, and you've walked away from the deal. So I don't think it's going to get back as to extreme of a shutdown scenario as we saw last summer, because I don't think either party is having much interested in having that fight in late September heading into an election year. But I do think there's going to be a lot of discussion over who walked away and who broke the deal.
Clarence, you're watching this. The Republicans looking to frame this up as are we going to have an economy, a culture of freedom, or one of dependency? Do you think that sticks? Is that going to be the framework? Surely President Obama is not going to enjoy or easily accept that as the ground on which he fights. But is that got legs, Clarence?
Well, they are trying to frame the debate that way. I think if they win this gamble, it's going to defy precedent because Medicare is still, as Susan alluded to, still a third rail program that older folks, especially, and older folks do vote 2-3 times more often and loyally and reliably than younger folks, feel that you shouldn't touch it. An election year is a terrible time for a serious debate about this because, indeed, the program is very popular. It's also not sustainable in the
And there it's going to be. Clarence Page with the Chicago Tribune joining us from Washington today. It's so great to have you with us. And Susan Davis with USA Today. Jack Beatty, all three, thanks very much to you. We're out of time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.